Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, and thank you for tuning in once again to Issues Concerning Women. I'm your host, Francine Humphrey, and as always, it's my pleasure and my delight to be with you. Tonight, we have a very special guest on the line. His name is Dr. Haywood Garrett Horton. He is a professor of sociology, and we're going to bring him on the line in just a few minutes. So just get your pencils and paper ready, sit back and relax, and get ready for the show. Tuning in to Issues Concerning Women. If this is your first time joining the show, thank you so much for tuning in tonight. If you are a regular follower of Issues Concerning Women, thank you as well. We are so excited tonight. We have a wonderful show for you. You're going to be impressed with our guest. His name is Dr. Haywood Derrick Horton. He is a professor of sociology and the School of Public Health at the State University of New York at Albany. He is a native of Norfolk, Virginia. He holds a BA in sociology from Norfolk State University and an MA and a PhD from the Pennsylvania State University. He has also held professorships at the University of Central Arkansas and Iowa State University. Professor Horton also is the Associate Dean of Graduate Studies in Albany since 2007. We have on the line tonight Dr. Haywood Horton. Dr. Horton, thank you for being on Issues Concerning Women.
Well, it's my pleasure to be here. My pleasure.
Thank you so much. We are so excited to have you on the program tonight. So we're just going to jump right in. Tonight we have a special show, ladies and gentlemen. We're going to be on for 1 hour. So I know you want to take notes. You're going to want to be prepared. So when he says something fantastic, that you can write it down. Or if you have questions and you want to call in and ask Dr. Horton a question, the telephone number to call in is 1-347-826-7543. And that's 1-347-826-7543. If you happen to miss the show tonight and you are listening to the recording, you can call me at 757-567-6734, and I'll have answers to all of your questions. But thank you for tuning in, and we're just going to get started. Professor Horton, you were C-SPAN a week ago
at
the Harlem Fair. So I want to start with that and tell us all about that program and why you were there and what was the panel discussion about.
Well, the panel dealt with race in the age of Obama. And I was there because I was a co-contributor to a volume with that title. And the paper that my colleagues and I wrote was entitled Racial Differences in the Perceptions of Racial Inequality in the Age of Obama. And dealt with a lot of exciting issues, and so I certainly am glad to talk about those tonight.
Wonderful, and we want to hear all about it. I happened to see the program, so I was very impressed with the panel. So one of the things that you talked about was the black community and how they are becoming more like other communities in their conversation and their actions. So can you elaborate a little bit on that?
Sure. Now, our research dealt with this whole issue of polarization in the black community. In other words, since the Civil Rights Movement, a number of us, as we all know, have had opportunities that our parents and grandparents had never dreamed of, whether you're talking about places that we work and places that we live. And so one of the arguments that was often being advanced was that as black people became more integrated with whites in terms of their communities, in terms of their work lives, actually you'd have a middle class black population that would perhaps be more similar to whites in their attitudes and beliefs than perhaps non-middle class blacks, blacks who were disadvantaged or working class. The interesting thing is that our research based on the American National Election Studies show that that is not the case. The bottom line is whether you're rich or poor, whether you're brother peddling on the street or whether you're Oprah, the reality is that if you're black, you understand racism is alive and well in America, and that the perceptions of black people do not differ across social class, and they are not more similar to whites. And that certainly was a major finding of our research.
Awesome. I know that this conversation is deep, and I want it, and I'm so excited because I've been on pins and needles all day. I couldn't wait, you know, to get you on the line to talk about this. You also brought up some great facts about the election when President Obama was elected and the percentages of those who voted for him. Can you talk a little bit about that message that you brought?
Now, one of the interesting things about this whole argument about President Obama's election is that his election signaled the beginning of a colorblind society where race is no longer important. Well, our study revealed that nothing could be further from the truth. Only 43% of the white electorate voted for President Obama. Only 43%. Let me say that a slightly different way. 57% of the white electorate, or almost 6 out of 10, voted against President Obama. And so to say that this is a post-racial society is far from the truth. Now, what about the percentages for other groups? Well, 95% of black voters voted for President Obama. 67% of Latinos and 63% of Asians voted for President Obama. So, again, when you say this is a post-racial society, that is not the case. It is clearly well over 9 out of 10 blacks, and the majority of Latinos and Asians voted for Barack Obama, and only a minority of whites voted for Barack Obama. That's another way of saying, certainly, the president needed that 43% of the white vote.
Yes.
But without the 95%, the 67%, and the 63% of blacks, Latinos, and Asians, he would not have won.
That is so interesting. And when we watch the news media, and I'm sure since this election has happened, many more families and groups and organizations are now taking a look at what is happening in society, where before we kind of like let things happen. So now that we have our eyes open, how can we as a community be more, empowering or gain power so that we know exactly what is going on and have an understanding of it?
Well, the first thing we have to understand is what was the meaning of President Obama's election? The meaning is this. The meaning is if President Obama can win the White House with only 43% of the white vote, then that means that we can actually encourage youth at all levels. So we can have Kareem go for city council. We can have Lisi go for the mayor's office. And we can have Natasha go for the governorship. The bottom line is that we have to make sure that young adult and youth realize that President Obama represents the fact that they can be full participants in this society. And part of that means stepping up to the plate and running for office. We need more people in office, more people involved, more people in Congress. If we had more black people in Congress, we wouldn't have had this debt crisis.
Wow, that is phenomenal. And since you brought up the children, how can we help our children reach their full potential in education now? Because I know they don't teach certain subjects in school like African-American history and other minority history in elementary schools. That's not something that's prevalent. But how can we prepare our children to reach their full potential? And when do we start doing that?
Well, you know, that's an excellent question. When I was a young professor years ago, my first job at the University of Central Arkansas, there was an older black professor there who said to me something I'll never forget. He said, if we expect other people to teach our kids black history, that is like expecting wolves to tend sheep.
Wow.
And that was so powerful. And you see, the bottom line is, no matter what happens in the schools, at that dinner table, black kids should be getting black history. When you start talking about in the churches, they should be getting it. And no matter what assignments kids have in school, mom and dad are going to have to take the kids to the library, make them do their reports on black history, and make sure they know it. And see, that's our responsibility. It's not anybody else's responsibility. You know, we can't let folks forget. Another thing that same older professor, his name is Dr. Thiemann Taylor, by the way, at the University of Central Arkansas. I suspect he's retired now, but one thing that he said, another thing he said to me was, if we forget, who will remember? And so one of the things that we have to take responsibility for our history, for the future of our kids, and it starts young. So when it comes Christmas time, instead of all the stuff that's advertised, we need to buy games and materials on black history. So it's right there in the home.
They're there.
You've got to find them.
Right.
So black history is the beginning. It's the foundation for understanding who we are.
Yes, that is absolutely true. Do you think, and we were talking about youth and the family, do you think as a society that we have forgotten the struggle? You know, is 200 years later, where are we now kind of thing? Or do you think we just don't talk about it as much because there's so much other things going on in the world right now?
I think that there's a lot of evidence to show that our kids are not getting it, and it's our responsibility. One of the things that's so interesting about this whole issue is this. We as a people have been so busy trying to give our kids what we didn't have that we forgot to give them what we had.
Wow.
What we had was a strong sense of community. What we had was a feeling of kinship, a peoplehood to somebody who was black like you. It didn't matter what they knew of them.
Right.
You felt a kinship there. And that now, unfortunately, we have a generation of black folks that just see themselves as quote-unquote individuals. And the problem is American society doesn't see us as individuals. And so we've got a problem in terms of how we are misinterpreting the situation. And until we go back to some of the things that our ancestors taught us and some of the lessons that they learned in terms of our survival as a people, I think that the whole idea of there being a unified approach to dealing with some of these current issues is not likely to occur, or it's going to be very difficult because we're losing that cohesiveness, the glue that kept us together.
Absolutely. And we see now more and more that the grandparents are not the grandparents that we had in our generations, where we had Big Mama and Meemaw that would sit us down and talk to us about where we came from and how the struggle began and when they built the railroad, they were there. How do we get back to that? Or is that something that also has been forgotten?
Again, it comes back to this whole sense of community. It comes back to neighbors caring about each other, caring about each other's kids. If in fact you see a young mother who's having some problems or who may need some help in terms of raising their kids, then as an older adult, what we have to do is to sit down and talk with them and to help them, offer to help and offer to spend that time. You know, we get so busy doing everything and nothing that the reality is that we're forgetting some of those things that are important. The time that we invest in that young man or young woman right now may very well mean that that person won't end up behind bars or prematurely killed or whatever. Now we've got to do something in terms of making sure we don't lose the next generation. And what that means is reaching out. Now, you know, we hear folks say all the time, and certainly you and I know that when we were coming up, there was more of a community feel where parents, any adult could chastise a child if they were doing wrong.
Absolutely.
Today, if somebody chastised your child, you're ready to fight.
Yes,
and
the child may fight you.
There you go. And or cussing you out.
That's right.
So the time that type of respect for elders, the type of caring for people who aren't necessarily your blood kin.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying it's totally gone, but it's not the way it used to be. And those are some of the lessons. Those are some of the things that we have to get back.
Absolutely, and that is a profound statement. We have to get it back. And we have to come together as a community and to pull together and use our resources to help these young people. So I'm on board with you 100% with that. So we're going to talk a little bit more about some of the things that you have been doing, Dr. Horton, because you have a repertoire as long as my arms. I want you to talk a little bit about some of the articles that you have written. Where are you still teaching now? And what are some of the projects that you have coming up?
Well, one of the things I'm really excited about is this whole idea of black entrepreneurship. You know, in our community, we have a long tradition, even prior to the emancipation of entrepreneurship. And one of the things that we have to get back to, particularly in today's economy, is we have to communicate, again, to our youth that we want you to go to school. We want you to get a good education. And we want you to find a good job. But an alternative is to start your own business and create your own job. And we have to, we have a strong tradition of entrepreneurship, but unfortunately, like the rest of our history, much of that is lost. And we have to recapture that. You know, I was talking to a gentleman in Houston, from Houston today. He was a friend of a friend, and he called me. And we were talking about the Black Wall Street. A lot of people have never heard of the Black Wall Street. But the Black Wall Street refers to a black community in Tulsa, Oklahoma, at the first part of the 20th century. It was a thriving community. In fact, it was a community that was so prosperous, they called it Black Wall Street, and it was a community where the black people were better off than the white people.
Okay.
But what happened was in 1921, the whites used as a pretense that a young black guy had said something to a white woman, and they did, and they rioted, and they destroyed the black businesses. They destroyed black homes. They killed a lot of black people.
Mm-hmm.
So just the property loss alone. Today would translate into billions. But let me tell you something else about Tulsa in 1921. One of those white rioters happened to be a veteran of World War One, and I don't know what he was doing with a plane, but he literally dropped a bomb on the black community. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Oh my goodness.
Yes. Here's the thing. This doesn't make it in our history books. But this is the first time that a bomb had been dropped on American soil. It was not 9/11. It was in 1920 in Tulsa, and it was dropped on the black community. And that's been pretty much erased out of American history.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of white folks don't know about that. I recommend everybody go on the web and look up the Black Wall Street.
Okay.
And so, but getting back, this entrepreneurship is part of our history, and it is something that is part of our culture, and it's something that has to be revived. Because if we have many more black folks, we have the ingenuity, we have the creativity, we have the resourcefulness. We just have to have many more persons to guide and to inspire.
Mm-hmm.
And we could have an entrepreneurial explosion in the black community. I truly believe that.
Yes, and I agree with you, again, 100%, because this is what we teach. And, Dr. Hart, let me ask you, do you think that in this day and time, because we may not be motivated to start a business, how can we get the black community interested or any communities, for that matter, interested in starting their own businesses, because that's what America was built on, you know, starting the mom-and-pop businesses. How can we get them excited again?
Well, here's the interesting thing. This is the perfect time, because the history and the research shows that more small businesses are started during hard economic times than any other. Why? Because the regular jobs aren't there. And so people mm-hmm. turn to self-employment to survive. So this is the perfect time to ignite an entrepreneurial movement. The jobs aren't there. And it still is the case that black folks are last hired, first fired.
Mm-hmm.
And so it should not be a very difficult sell. Now, let me add another little caveat here. And that is, as you know, we have far too many brothers and nowadays sisters who have gotten part of the criminal justice system.
Mm-hmm.
Well, too often, when these brothers and sisters get out of prison, They can't find a job. Nobody will give them a fair shot.
Mm-hmm.
And oftentimes they have to fall back into the underground economy. I believe that entrepreneurship is an answer. We need organizations and leaders to, in essence, develop programs that will lead these youth into entrepreneurship.
Okay.
And so, and that's a that is another natural source of young black entrepreneurs.
I'm
excited about just the idea of being able to convince a young man or a young woman that no matter what their background, no matter what they've experienced, what have you, there's another way. And that way is to be self-employed.
Great. And since we're talking about entrepreneurship, if you could encourage someone that was listening right now and they wanted to start a business, what would be one or two things that you would be able to tell them to get them started?
One of the first things I would tell them is to contact the Small Business Administration. They have programs that are set up to help young persons or anyone who is interested in becoming self-employed, whether you're talking about training, helping them to develop a business plan, helping them to actually gain access to resources, that is all there. It is amazing how many resources, particularly, are in government that black folks don't take advantage of. But black folks pay for it because we pay a disproportionate amount of taxes.
Absolutely.
And so basically, to the extent that everybody pays for it, but not everybody uses a resource, that means those people who do use a resource literally get it for free.
So that's
the first thing. I would tell them to contact the Small Business Administration. Sit down. They have programs. They even have a mentoring program where retired business people will sit down with an individual and help them step by step develop their plan and help them to get started.
Great. That's great information. Yes. And do you see the community at large stepping up to help these young men and women start businesses? Because if they're transitioning out of the prison system or social service system, once they're out back in the community, how are we going to be able to reach them?
That is an excellent question. One of the things that we're going to be initiating soon, starting in the Washington, D.C. area, we're going to be initiating an entrepreneurship program that's community-based. And what we want to do is to begin to identify existing leaders and develop a coalition among existing businessmen and women so that we can mentor these youth and help them to get started. And so it's going to take an effort of people who are like-minded, who are concerned about the future, and who want to give these youth a chance. And there are, fortunately, there are a lot of programs, particularly, for instance, like the Black Community Developers, who actually work with people who were formerly incarcerated. Well, an entrepreneurship piece would be an excellent component to be added to those types of programs. There are a number of churches who have strong outreach programs, and we would start with some of those leaders. I'm certain they have a number of those in the Hampton Roads area as well.
Yes, absolutely. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Issues Concerning Women, and our special guest today is Dr. Haywood Horton. And he's a professor of psychology
and he is presiding right now in Albany, New York. But he came on Issues Concerning Women to open the dialogue and to have conversations about the youth, entrepreneurship, and before he goes, we want to talk a little bit about Issues Concerning Women. So we're going to take a break for just a few seconds so he can catch his breath, and we'll be right back. So stay tuned to Issues Concerning Women. Welcome back to Issues Concerning Women. If you're just tuning in, I'm your host, Francine Allen Humphrey. We are on every Thursday night at 8:30 p.m., so please tune in to the show. Tonight is a special night because we're having a one-hour show. So if you missed the first half of the show, we're going into our second half. We have about 28 more minutes to go. If you would like to call in and ask the question, telephone number is 1-347-826-7543, and that's 1-347-826-7543. Tonight we have Dr. Haywood Horton, Professor of Psychology and the Public of School and the School of Public Health at the State University of New York at Albany. Dr. Horton, we are so happy to have you on the show, and I just want to jump right in there and say thank you once again for taking the time out of your busy schedule to be on Issues Concerning Women. We really appreciate you, and we're glad that you can join us tonight.
My pleasure, and I just want to also note that I'm professor of sociology, and one of the most exciting things about what's going on in the community and the research that we've been doing is the fact that women are at the heart and soul of what we believe is the future of the Black community, and so it really is an honor to be on this program.
Thank you, we are more than honored to have you. If you missed the first half of the show, now you're going to have to go back and listen to the first half because it was deep. Now I'm going to tell you guys, you don't want to miss this. So you will be able to hear the recording right after the show. So if you missed the first 3 minutes, now we're going to flip the script a little bit and let's talk about women in the community and their contributions to the Black community and all the communities as well. So, Dr. Horton, just give me some insight on that.
Well, you know, I've done quite a bit of research on Black community development and began to look at what are some of the things of successful Black communities throughout history. And there are a lot of important components, but one consistent component is an emphasis on Black female leadership.
It really is as simple as this.
Historically, no Black church, no Black community. Okay?
Yes.
But no Black women, no Black church.
That's right.
It really is that simple. Women, they're the backbone of community.
Yes.
And one thing that happens is that the men just aren't there. We talked about all the time about what's happened with terms of incarceration and then the homicide, et cetera. So a disproportionate amount of the best talent in the community is female. We're not saying that Black women are more talented than Black men. That's not what we're saying. What we're saying is it's the Black women that are there. And so as a result, just as historically Black women had to work, long before white women had to work, because white men were not allowed to compete with white men in the labor force, Black women also had to step up in terms of leadership roles. But oftentimes, historically, even though black women were the leaders, they actually stayed behind the scenes and allowed men to take the glory. And you would see that all the time in church.
Yes.
But the reality is that today we can't afford that luxury. We have to have black women up front where they belong. And because that's the talent. We need the best talent available. And right now, disproportionately so, the best talent available is female. And that's where the leadership is going to come. I predict that the next black president is going to be a black woman.
All right, man. A shout out to the black women and all the women. Yes, that would be awesome. Yes, awesome. The next question that I had for you, a lot of times we still look at corporate America as being the man's world. So how, as women, should we pinpoint companies that advance women? Should we be looking for that now with the economy the way that it is? Or should we go back to that entrepreneurial piece and create our own businesses?
I believe that ultimately what we're talking about is entrepreneurship as being the key. However, even in the corporate structure, as you said, in today's economy, if someone's going to offer you a good job and that's a job that you want, you should certainly go for it, okay? But once you're in that position, one thing you have to understand is that the people who move to the top of any organization, anywhere, are the people who are mentored. And oftentimes, one of the problems is oftentimes people mentor people that look like them. And so if there are any of us at the top, then we're not likely to be mentored, whether you're talking about black men or black women. And so one of the things that that black women have to do is to look for their mentors elsewhere. Because that is almost the only way that they're going to get the grooming that they need to be able to reach the next levels. A lot of the subtleties of networking, of corporate culture, they won't get unless they have a good mentor. And that what that means is they're going to often have to find those mentors outside of those official structures. And oftentimes, black women will find that white women won't necessarily mentor them. So you're going to have to find your mentors elsewhere. And ironically enough, those mentors are there. They may necessarily be in the corporate structure, but you'll find your mentors elsewhere. That's what you're going to have to do. Similarly for black men, an excellent place to find the type of corporate mentorship that we often need are in some of our organizations, particularly our black Greek fraternities and sororities. There you have a corporate structure and an organization that is designed to reach out to young black women and men. And so we would turn, and historically, those organizations have provided phenomenal leadership. I know that many organizations, particularly Alpha Phi Alpha, was one of the major players in the during the Civil Rights Movement. As we all know, Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King was an alpha. And so these organizations certainly have a place and still have a place in terms of providing the grooming, the mentorship that is needed. And let me also do a little truth in advertising. I, too, am an alpha. And I remember at Norfolk State, one of the things that we had was a mentoring program, and we would go into the projects. I had every Saturday, and we would actually tutor young black kids on their basic reading, writing, arithmetic, because they weren't getting it in the classroom, and providing role models. Today, I'm a part of a graduate chapter here in Albany, but there are graduate chapters throughout the country and throughout the world. And in every graduate chapter, we have mentoring programs We mentor young men and young women, providing scholarships, et cetera. These organizations are the place where you can find people with a type of corporate experience that will help you and provide you with the mentorship that you won't get in corporate America.
Awesome. That is some awesome information. And I hope you are writing these things down. And if you have questions after the show, please call me at 757-567-6734, and I'll be able to get you more information about some of the programs that Dr. Horton is talking about. Dr. Horton, I know that you reside in New York now, but you did mention that you are a native of Norfolk, Virginia, and you attended Norfolk State University. So I know that you come back and forth and that you're doing a lot of things in the community. And so we're just so proud to, again, to have you with Issues Concerning Women tonight. I know that you have some other publications that you're going to be, that you are working on and some that you already published. So can you talk a little bit about that?
Certainly. One of the things that we want to certainly showcase is our whole idea of the black working class. Right now I'm actually writing a book with a colleague, Dr. Lori Martin at John Jay College in New York City, on the black working class. In fact, it's entitled Lost in the Storm, America's Black Working Class. And
I'm listening. Oh, I'm excited.
Oh, okay.
Right now. I'm taking my notes. Lost in the storm.
The title comes from a classic article that I was a lead author of with a couple of colleagues. It came out in 2000. And this article is entitled Lost in the Storm. And one of the things that we did was we used census data, and we looked at the black working class from 1850 to 1990. Or in other words, we actually looked at the black working class before the emancipation. And one of the things that we were able to find out is that not only today are most black people working class, the working class, the black working class today is larger than the white working class ever was. So when you see these pictures on TV the stereotypes, no, most black people don't fall in the categories of Good Times nor the Cosbys. Most black people, are working class people, blue collar people. They're not poor, and they're not wealthy. They're working class, and so this is important because when you start looking at issues that impact the working class, for instance, when you start talking about the movement of jobs overseas, when you start talking about the transformation in the American economy from one that's based upon manufacturing to one that's based upon information and services, when that impacts the black, the working class more so, but the black working class even more than the white working class, because the black population is more working class. And so we're looking at these issues, and the question is, so what does this mean for policy? You know, I would argue, and one of the things we're finding is that a lot of this disruption during this recession is actually forcing not only a lot of middle class people back to the working class, but it also means that if you're already working class, you're also probably closer to falling back into poverty, and so. We have to develop issues and policies that really focus on making sure that we provide opportunities for people in the working class, and particularly those in the black working class. Once again, I don't want to hark back to an earlier conversation, but I do believe one key is entrepreneurship.
Right. That is awesome. And I know the callers on the line, are listening, and I hope they're absorbing what you are talking about. And that's why I wanted to do the hour show tonight, because I know it was so many questions that I had just from seeing you on C-SPAN, and, you know, you and I have talked on several occasions, but not in-depth conversation like this, and I really wanted you to be able to express yourself and talk about some of the things that you have been doing and the models that you have put together and the publications for the community. I hope that you have enjoyed the show tonight. Dr. Horton is a professor, and he has so much information, so we could go on and on for 2 hours. So since you brought the entrepreneur piece back up, let's jump back to that, because a lot of my listeners are business owners and executives in their careers. Most entrepreneurs have many great ideas, and oftentimes they get sidetracked and stop moving forward. So how do you bring your best ideas to fruition?
That is an excellent question. And here is what I believe is an excellent answer. Understand that whether you're talking about entrepreneurship or whether you're talking about being in any other type of profession, nobody gets where they are alone. There's no such thing as just pulling yourself up by your own bootstraps. Somebody's got to provide you with some boots, okay? And so it comes right back to this whole idea of mentoring. Understanding that this is your business, but the best way to be successful in your business is to take advantage of the experience of people who have been successful at it. And so if you're willing to be mentored, earlier I talked about fraternities and sororities, but let's also talk about universities, okay? Many, if not most universities actually have entrepreneurship centers or business development centers where they actually work with local and small businesses, helping them with their planning. And in many cases, many universities actually have incubators right on campus, so a business can get its start working out of a space right there at the university, or a space in the community that the university has established. And so the bottom line is that if you are an entrepreneur, there are resources out there. You don't have to be alone. You can go, if you're in Norfolk, you can go right over there to Norfolk State.
Mm-hmm.
And so the point is that the key is understanding that you don't have to reinvent the wheel. There is a system. There are some principles of business success, and if you don't know them or understand them, there are people out there who are willing to help you. In fact, there are people out there whose job it is to help you.
Yes.
And so after tonight, those people who are listening can never say that nobody told them.
That's the truth. And that's awesome for them to hear as well, because and that's one of the things that we do with Issues Concerning Women. We talk about and we train on entrepreneurship. We partner with businesses, colleges and universities, the private sector, city and state. We have to be invited in to do that, but we also partner with a lot of nonprofit organizations. So I know that you have started probably many businesses. So how do we get funding in this day and time for our businesses? Because I know that one of your pieces you talk about grassroots. So can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Without question. Obviously, there are a number of ways of being getting funded, and certainly a tried and true way is to, if you already are working, to save some resources, partner with other people, and begin to invest in yourselves that way. However, let me point something out, and this really relates also to Black women, by the way, and women in general. a lot of people don't realize that the federal government perhaps does more business with small businesses than any other entity. In fact, the federal government does approximately $450 to $500 billion of business every year. And they have special programs for minority and women businesses and women-owned businesses. And so a woman-owned business means that a woman owns at least 51% of the business. And so it takes some work. But once again, going through those processes of learning how and getting the mentoring and advice from various resource people and organizations, one can become a contractor with the federal government and bid on some of those billions of dollars. Let me tell you something. You don't have to be greedy. A simple million mm-hmm. will probably set many people free. And so you don't need a billion dollars. You don't need a $1 billion contract. In fact, there's certain jobs that can be as low as about tens of thousands of dollars. But that's a way to get you started. And sometimes the government uses all kinds of products, from products and services, from janitorial services to anything as pens and pencils to plumbing, any type of service that can be offered, the federal government contracts for. And so it can be as high-end as technology. It can be low-end as janitorial. But the bottom line is that is the source. There's similar programs at the state and local levels, but most of the opportunities are with the federal government.
Okay, great. And somebody probably is listening and going, well, how do I find that out? And I always say do your research and do your homework and get out there and go. If you don't have a computer at home, go to the library and use your resources. Or, again, going right back to that mentorship piece, finding somebody that you see that has prospered in the community, because that's the kind of people that you want to connect with. And like you stated earlier, it doesn't always have to be somebody that's doing what you're doing or somebody that looks like you. It has to be somebody that is moving forward, that has done what you want to do, and you mentor them and you shadow them. So I think that's great advice. And I know that the listeners are taking notes and writing all these things down. And at least I hope they are, because if you didn't, you can go back and listen to the show after we get off the air. Dr. Horton, being that you were on the panel at C-SPAN mm-hmm. and you had the opportunity to speak about President Obama and his first years in office, can you give us a little bit of insight on what has been happening this week? We know the debt ceiling, they got something signed, but can you explain that, because we only got about 6 minutes, so in the next 3 minutes, can you kind of explain what actually happened on Tuesday? I believe that was the day.
Basically, the federal government is in a situation that it has to borrow money in order to pay its bills, okay? And so, essentially, by raising the debt limit, that means that the federal government is able to borrow more money in order to pay its bills. Okay? If not, that's like, if you didn't raise the debt limit, that's like saying that your credit card was declined and you had all these bills coming in that you couldn't pay. It really was as simple as that. So the federal government today is perhaps one of the biggest borrowers of money in the world. And in order to pay its bills, because the federal government is running a deficit, it has to borrow money. And it's really as simple as that. It's just the same way as you as an individual. If you want to, in order for you to sometimes be able to get over a hump, you have to borrow some money. And if somebody tells you that you've reached your limit and you can't. That means that in that case, there will be a number of bills that you wouldn't be able to pay. It really is as simple as that.
Mm. And thank you. And I wanted somebody to explain it that it can make sense to the ordinary ear that was hearing it. Because we look at all the commentary and the different programs that are on, it can be quite confusing. And some of them, I know that they really don't know what they're talking about. And if you don't know anything about politics, and then you're listening to that, you're really confused. And I think a lot of people are confused. And we have 4 minutes. So somebody, I was listening to a radio show on Wednesday, and they talked about President Obama. And one of the things that he said when he was coming into office, he said that the government would be more transparent. Do you think he has accomplished that goal?
Absolutely.
Since he come into office?
One of the things that President Obama did was to appoint professionals from the private sector to set up the technology so that the federal government would be able to easily document and show to the general public through their websites exactly what was being spent and for what, by whom, and how much. And never before has so much information been available on what the government spends. There's a website that actually is a central location. I'm trying to remember the name of that website. It ends with a .gov. I can certainly get back to you on that. But the bottom line is that President Obama has done more to make this government transparent than any president in history.
Great, that is awesome. Dr. Horton, we have about 3 more minutes. So,
are there any callers?
We didn't get a caller. They're probably just listening online. We have people online, but they didn't ask a question. Because they want to ask a question, they have to push the button and their microphones will light up. So they're listening, but they don't want to ask a question.
Well,
I guess they want to listen and take notes, so we're hoping that's what they're doing. So,
I hope I answered all the questions that they had.
Absolutely. And if they did not, they can call me and ask me the question. I'll ask you, and we'll get back to them. So, Dr. Horton, we have about 2 minutes left. So you've done a lot in your career. And could you just, in the next minute, tell me what your greatest reward has been since you've been an adult. We'll put it that way, because you've done a lot, so we can't list everything that you've done. That would be another hour show. But what has
been
your greatest reward? Yes.
My greatest reward was seeing my daughter walk across the stage at Norfolk State with her degree.
All right. All right. That is powerful.
That my job was done. I said, if I close my eyes for the last time that night, it'd be all right, because I did my job.
That is absolutely wonderful and absolutely powerful. And and I can tell by your voice that you're very proud of her, and I'm sure she's proud of you. She said so, actually, on Facebook. So if you don't know who Dr. Horton is after all of this, and you can go on Facebook and you can follow him. He follows me, and I follow him, so if you want to go to my Facebook page, and that's Francine Humphrey at Facebook.com, and you'll see Dr. Horton there. And somebody just called in, so they have a question. Let me see, can we get their question on right quick?
Sure.
Hello, caller.
Hello.
And what
I've really been enjoying this
out?
Program.
Let me check it. Pardon me, I'm sorry.
Okay, really quick. Really quick, this question is for Dr. Horton. Dr. Horton, you spoke about how we need to come together as a community and there needs to be some mentorship. And something that I've always spoken to my elders about is that there seems to be a gap between the civil rights generation and the generation now. So how can we take that generation, which would be your generation, to really reach out to the younger folks and really mentor them a bit more? What can we do to bridge that divide?
As part of bridging that divide is actually people coming together around common interests. And that common interest is the survival of our children. The bottom line is, if we as adults, whether we are older adults, middle-aged adults like me, or young adults like you, if we don't come together and come up with ways of teaching and mentoring the younger ones, then our community is going to be lost. And so as a result, that commonality of understanding that our survival is just important. That commonality, that urgency, should bring some people together, and not everybody, but there are going to be enough like-minded people. You start with the few, and you build on it. That's how you start. But the fact is that there are enough people across the generation who care about these kids, who are willing to come together and to come up with some solutions. I believe that's where you start, and probably right there in the church with some of the sisters there would be a great place to start, because they know how to nurture and to love.
Well, wonderful. Thank you, Dr. Horton. And I have to be honest. This is your daughter calling in. I just wanted to say I really enjoyed tonight. So thank you.
Thank you.
I just need to recognize you.
I'll talk to you later. Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Humphrey, for having him on. Have a great night.
You're so welcome. Thank you. Dr. Horton, that was so cute.
That was so shocking.
I know. So we're going to get off the
line. I didn't even recognize her.
Thank you so much. The hour just went so quickly. Thank you, daughter, for calling in. What is your daughter's name?
Her name is Natasha.
Okay, Natasha. Thank you. Natasha. Thank you for calling in, and I'm glad she enjoyed the show. Dr. Horton, thank you so much. You know we've gone out of our time, so I'm going to have you come back to Issues Concerning Women. Thank you, sir. We really appreciate you taking the time out of your busy schedule to join us.
Thank you, and it's been my pleasure.
Have a wonderful night. Good night.
Good night. Take care.
Thank you.